For WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In California, Washington, Alaska, and Idaho, across the West, and even in states like North Carolina and Texas, fires are burning up hundreds of thousands of acres. They're uprooting people and destroying almost everything in their path, and they keep getting hotter, faster, more deadly. With drought, development, and climate change, experts are rethinking how to prevent and how to manage wildfires. This hour on Point, our forests ablaze and what to do about it. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let's hear a little bit of sound to get a sense of what the country is dealing with. In Lake County, California, resident Chris Cassio spoke to KTVU last Monday. He said firefighters were able to save his house, but the other outbuildings on his ranch were gone.
Just devastation. Everything was burnt. There's no brush around our property no more.
And in Iowa, the Soda Fire has grown to more than 200,000 acres. RV park owner Turk Reese said he wanted fire evacuees to know that he was offering free space to camp until the fire is contained.
So smoky, and there's an orange glow through here all day, and you see the helicopters going back and forth. You just know right away that it's got to be bad.
Reese says he has lost two different homes with his family in past fires. Now let's go to California, which is the state with the busiest wildfire season this year. Crews are now battling 14 fires there. Joining me from San Francisco is Pete Fimwright. He reports on the environment, natural resources, and public lands for the San Francisco Chronicle. Pete also used to be a firefighter. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a sense of the damage out there from the fires. What kind of destruction are you seeing left in their wake?
Well, I mean, obviously there's thousands of acres that have been destroyed, and then many homes, dozens of homes have been burned down. So, you know, about 1,000 more fires than last year, which was a big fire season as well. So there's quite a bit of devastation, yeah.
There's one fire that I think has been about 100 miles north of San Francisco, which sounds like a safe distance, but I understand that some people in the Bay Area, I think Oakland Hills, had days where they said they actually smelled smoke. Is it reaching in that sense to even very heavily populated urban areas?
Yes, it is. I mean, the Lake Fire, which I think you're talking about, called the Rocky Fire. It's in near Clear Lake. It was sending smoke plumes 30,000 feet into the air, and there's still a bunch of fires going on in Trinity County, far north of there, and their smoke is now reaching the San Francisco Bay Area. So yeah, people are smelling smoke. The smoke is wafting even farther, I think, now.
There's also a fire called the Jerusalem Fire. I think at this point it has burnt almost 25,000 acres. How are crews doing at containing that fire and the other fires?
Well, I think the Jerusalem fire is about 85% contained right now. So they've pretty much got that under wraps. And the same with the fire I just mentioned, the Rocky Fire, which is right in the same area. The crews seem to have gotten a handle on a lot of these fires, except for several that are still going on in Trinity County. But you know, it's still somewhat alarming how they burn. They've been burning very erratically and very quickly, and it's been hard for firefighters to get them under control, and we haven't even reached the peak fire season, which is normally in the fall, so that's a concern.
The erratic burning you talked about is quite interesting, and I hope we get to that more later this hour, because since the 1970s, computer models have been used to predict how fires will behave, but I understand that recently fires have been behaving so unpredictably that the models aren't very useful, so that really makes it difficult in terms of tactical approach to how firefighters fight fires.
Yes, absolutely. In the Rocky Fire, for instance, like I mentioned, the clouds that reach 30,000 feet, they create their own weather, and as they collapse, they shoot fire in all directions, And in the Rocky Fire, they would have a fire line and embers would fly over them as far as a mile and start fires behind them. And that's particularly dangerous because firefighters can get trapped in between two fires. And that's part of the erratic nature of it. And they're creating their own weather as well. The wind is, the wind caused by the fire is making it even more erratic. So,
Peter, this unpredictability you're talking about is what really concerns fire experts and makes them think we have to totally rethink how we fight fires. On the other hand, fires have now just become a part of living in the West for many people. And as you said, some of the big fires are almost 85% contained. So do you get the sense that residents are taking this very seriously, or do they just sort of feel like it's life during fire season, we'll move on? How is there a disconnect between how the experts feel and the people who live through these feel?
Well, I think most residents of California are aware that fire is a danger. I mean, it has always been here. We have such a dry summer that there are normally fires. But I think that the extreme dryness from the 4 years of drought has people very concerned. And I think people notice that these fires are tending to be more intense than they have in the past. And so I think there's a great deal of concern. And firefighters are very concerned. So they're getting the word out. So I think there is concern.
That's Peter Fimwright. He's an environmental reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Peter, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And now joining us from Boise, Idaho, just north of the Soda Fire we mentioned, which is that major wildfire that has burnt more than 250,000 acres, is Ron Dunton. He's the Assistant Director for Fire and Aviation for the Bureau of Land Management, and he's based at the National Interagency Fire Center. Ron Dunton, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
And I should mention that I think someone who works for you was originally going to come on the show, but he's dealing with a fire that was serious enough that he had to go to a strategy meeting today, which caused a conflict. So I think that really speaks to how serious this is and how unpredictable and how quickly people are having to move and decide what to do about this.
You're correct. The individual originally scheduled is heavily involved in plotting national strategy, essentially.
And so he had to be there to help decide how to deal with the latest emergency. Ron Dunton, we just heard Peter Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle talk about these fires being more intense in the past. Can you give us a sense of what you see these fires, how you see them being differently than fires you have dealt with in the past?
You know, I'm not sure I would say they're more intense. There's more scrutiny on them. Maybe the biggest change we've seen over the past 30 to 40 years is very seldom can you have a fire now, a large wildfire, that doesn't impact communities. We have extreme burning conditions today, but we've had extreme burning conditions, through the 90s, through the 80s. But as communities spread, there's just more impact, there's more attention to the fire, and it's a complicating factor in terms of how we fight the fire. And it's not just California, it's really across the West.
So there's a man-made aspect to this in a sense, because if we have homes and businesses built very close to woodlands that might catch fire, they may not have been there decades ago, and maybe those fires could have just been let to burn. Is that the idea?
That's part of it. It certainly changes how we approach a fire. Our priority, and this is a national interagency priority, is life of our firefighters and public safety. So we have to take that into account on every fire that we fight. So if we have communities threatened, that has to be the top of the priority. We can't allow a fire just to burn unchecked.
Last week, the National Fire Preparedness Level was raised to the highest level it can go. That's level 5. What does that mean exactly about the seriousness?
Essentially, it means that we are fully committed with all our national resources. We don't have any spare capacity. We start the process to activate the military. We're doing that over the weekend. We've entered into discussions with Australia, New Zealand, to potentially bring those folks in. They're very well suited for our type of fire, and of course their winter is our summer, so we match up real well with them.
Is that because we have tapped out, really, the available firefighters in the U.S.?
We've pretty well tapped out United States resources. We have Canadian resources coming in. And like I said, we're activating military units. And then we have to shift, really look hard at various priorities and shift resources from one incident to another.
Ron, do you know how many of this season's fires have been caused not by something like a lightning strike, but by humans? And I don't mean necessarily arson. I mean, say, someone didn't put out a campfire correctly or a car sparked a blaze somewhere.
You know, I don't off the top of my head. Human-caused fires remain a problem. And when you think about it, human-caused fires are generally in areas of communities. So that just complicates issues. But the bulk of the fires we're dealing with today are lightning-caused fires from storms we had a couple weeks ago. Some of them are remote country, but we had a case this last week where lightning started a series of fires right around the outskirts of Chelan, Washington, and the fire burned through the town.
Mm. We're talking this hour about wildfires, and you can join the conversation. Are there changes you think we need to make to protect ourselves from wildfires? Ron Dunton is still with us. He's Assistant Director for Fire and Aviation for the Bureau of Land Management at the National Interagency Fire Center based in Boise, Idaho. And also joining us now from Walnut Creek, California, is Scott Stevens. He's a professor of fire science with the Department of Environmental Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and he directs the UC Center for Fire Research and Outreach there. Scott Stevens, welcome to On Point.
Happy to be here.
And Ron and Scott, let's hear another little bit of sound so we can get a sense of what the impact of some of these fires are. This is the Sockeye Fire, which started near Willow, Alaska on June 14th. So we're talking about 2 months ago. Residents were evacuated to Houston, Alaska. And evacuee Greg Hatfield told Alaska Public Media that everything he had went up in flames.
Little cabin out there right at Little Willow. So I know it's pretty well cooked. We was one of the first ones. We seen a helicopter flying around us. Seen some smoke, but nothing we could do. We just got out of there.
Ron Dunton, give us an idea of the kind of equipment that is used to battle these types of large fires in particular.
It's everything from fire engines that people are very familiar with. Bulldozers are very common. Aircraft ranging from large jets, what we call our very large air tanker, which is a converted DC-10 that can carry 11,000 gallons of fire retardant, down to the smaller jets and very small single-engine air tankers. So we have a whole variety of tools out there in the toolbox. And then last but certainly not least are our line crews who are out there battling the fire, oftentimes in triple-digit heat. So we throw just every type of tool that we can at the fire. We don't depend on one particular tool. We have smoke jumpers. We have HeliTac crew members. It's a whole variety.
Ron, you mentioned fire retardants, and a comment came in a few minutes ago from a listener on our website. This is P.I. Mack, and he says, I'd like to see some discussion about the chemicals used when planes dump fire retardants. What are the long-term effects of these chemicals? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, it's been very closely studied. Environmental impact statements have been done on it. We believe the chemicals used are safe for the environment. We had some problems with some older chemicals 15 years ago, but we believe we've gotten beyond that. And again, the chemicals that we use, a lot of people are under an impression that all we have to do is get that fire retardant out there and we're good. The fire retardant can help hold the fire. It can help cool down a fire, but by no means will it by itself put the fire out. We have to have ground forces working in conjunction with it.
I read that one of the strategies for fighting fires sometimes is to fight the flanks, basically. So you sort of approach it from the sides, and then sometimes you wait for wind to push that fire towards a stream, so that water obviously becomes a natural benefit. So sometimes are you also incorporating in natural features that can help be firefighting allies, essentially?
Oh, certainly. We take advantage of the terrain. what you described, the flanking fire or a flanking attack, is pretty much a classic example. Worked from the what we call the tail of the fire up the sides and pinch it off. But on large fires in particular, we're looking at taking advantage of any natural barrier, generally burning out from them. There was a reference earlier about how far a fire can spot. Easily can spot out a mile ahead, depending on the type of fuel you're in. The Soda fire that was referenced, the 287,000-acre fire just about 30 miles out of Boise, highways, nothing was stopping it when it first picked up. But it had 30 to 40-mile-an-hour winds pushing it. So, yeah, we take advantage of rivers, other natural barriers, anything that's out there that will aid the effort.
Scott Stevens, professor of fire science at UC Berkeley, I have a question for you. And to precede that question, I want to play another piece of sound. This is in regards to the Rocky Fire in Northern California that has burned almost 70,000 acres. And this is Captain Steve Kaufman of the Ventura County Fire Department.
There are firefighters that have 20, 25, 30 years on the job that have never seen fire behavior like we've seen the last couple of days here on the Rocky Fire.
Scott Stevens, we mentioned a few minutes ago that data modeling for decades has been used to try to determine fire behavior, but that many firefighters say fires have become so erratic and unpredictable that it's very hard to model them and therefore hard to know how to fight them. Can you give us your sense, as you have over the years studied this, of how fires are changing in that way?
Yeah, I think what we're having here, certainly you've talked about drought. We've had 4 years of drought here. We've had, you know, very dry conditions. Fuels are basically at tinder dry levels. Our fire behavior models in this country are some of the best in the world. They were actually started in Missoula, Montana, and they've been worked on for years. But the one thing they don't do is they don't couple the fire to the atmosphere. So when you get these big plumes that are actually developed because of all this heat and really changing the local weather, changing the dynamics of the atmosphere, our fire behavior models will not take that into account. So that's what you mentioned. We don't have any really ability to really look at these blow-up fires very well at all. We can do kind of extreme fires, but the most severe, the ones that like the Rocky Fire, the Rim Fire, things like that, we have no real capacity to deal with those from a modeling standpoint because of just the nature of the atmosphere-fire coupling.
Scott, you use the term fuels, and I want to clarify here that I think this is sort of, there's a fascinating use of the word fuels when it comes to fires, and what you basically mean is branches, wood, small shrubs, things that can fuel a fire. So when people talk about fuels in the forest, they mean tinder, essentially, natural tinder like branches that could cause a fire. Is that right?
That's right. You're going to have the deadened down woody material that's on the ground that's been dead for years and that has a certain character. Then you also have all the fuels that are alive, the shrubs, the live trees, the grasses sometimes. So you have really a live pool and a dead pool, and then both of those are going to contribute to fire behavior. And the drought has really been impacting the live fuels more because of moisture content.
And I think it seems that there's widespread agreement that the fuels, the tinder, needs to be reduced, but not very much consensus on how. Is that fair to say?
I think that's right. You know, you talk about a shrubland fire regime, like some things like the Rocky Fire, a lot of shrubland systems versus a forest-dominated system where the forest we know used to, a lot of forests in the United States used to burn every 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You take fire out of those systems for 100 years, you profoundly change them. And the chaparral, the shrubland system, they burn less frequently, maybe 50, 60, 70 years. There the fuels haven't changed as much, but the ones where fire used to be frequent every 5, 10, 15 years, ponderosa pine forest, mixed conifer. You can do stuff in those systems, thinning, burning, actively restoration, that really could set them up to have a much better outcome when they do inevitably burn.
Scott, you mentioned drought, and that clearly is a factor in why the fires are so bad this season. Not only is the land very dry, but there's less water available to fight fire. You also mentioned, I think, Ron, development, you know, that firefighters have to focus on new areas where there are homes because they can't let the fire get to those homes. That changes the strategy. But then we also get to the issue of those fuels that some people say we need to thin our forests more. We need more planned or prescribed burns, which makes some people uncomfortable. They think that maybe that's a sneaky way to do logging, or they worry that a prescribed burn will get out of control. Can you, Ron Dunton, talk a little bit about what you think needs to be happening to try to not just suppress fires that have already started, but stop those fires or prevent those fires from ever starting?
I'm glad you asked that question. again, there's no one magic cure for some of the issues we're facing, particularly in the western United States. The concept of fire in the woodlands, is something people have a hard time grasping in terms of intentionally lighting fires. As I stated earlier, ponderosa pine forest should be burning every 7 to 10 years, so you have a low intensity burn. But once you take fire out of that, which fire has been this past century, you get to the point where you can't have a low intensity burn. You have to thin it before you can burn it. It becomes very expensive.
And a low intensity burn, by the way, is basically considered a good fire, right? One that kind of spreads seeds, thins out the forest.
In the right fuel type, yes. Ponderosa pine, low intensity is what you want. We have another issue that is facing us across particularly the Great Basin parts of part of the United States, southern Idaho, Nevada, Utah, eastern Oregon, and that's the invasion of cheatgrass and other invasive grasses that intensify the fire cycle to the other extreme. Instead of having fire in sagebrush country every 10 or every 20 to 30 years, we see the invasion of these annual grasses, and we start having fires every 2 to 3 years, which doesn't allow the native vegetation to come back in. The fires are extremely intense, fast-moving. That's why we end up with fires like the Soda Fire. So different geography, different ecosystems, fire plays a different role. But we need to bring fire back in some. In some, we need to stretch out the fire interval. We need to invest more on the fuel side of the house, what we'd call the doing fuels breaks or doing good burns in order to prevent the catastrophic burns. But it is hugely expensive. I was touring an area a couple weeks ago where to treat an acre of land, or 1 acre of land, you just think 1 acre was over $1,000.
It's hugely expensive, although ultimately does it become more expensive to have to fight massive fires that get out of control because we didn't take these preventive measures?
That's a very good point. It just depends on where the dollars come from, how Congress appropriates. You know, most of the land that we're engaged in is public lands of some sort, owned by the United States government, managed by different agencies, or by state government. So the public has a role in those types of decisions and how we're funded.
The money point is an important one because I read this very striking fact, which is that in 1995, so 20 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service spent 16% of its budget on fighting fires. It does many other things like recreation and research, and it takes care of roads and bridges. So 16% of its budget on fighting fires in 1995. It's now closer to half of that. And by 2025, there's a belief that that budget for fighting fires could approach 70%, which leaves even less money for doing some of the thinning and preventive burns. Scott Stevens, you do fire research. Why aren't we doing more to prevent fires from happening?
Well, the challenge is, as Ron alluded to, kind of this the logistics of it all, and also it's been ingrained for so long that fire has been this idea of the demon, the devil, and certainly more and more people are realizing now ecologically appropriate fire is absolutely appropriate, necessary. So we are beginning to see it turn in the tide. If you look at the southeast United States, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, they actually have quite an active prescribed fire program. It's actually one of the most interesting and successful prescribed burning programs in the nation or the world. So there are parts of the United States, actually, that actually are doing this today. They've been doing it for, you know, decades, 40 years or more. We need to transfer some of that idea, some of that know-how, some of the experience out here into the West. We've been slow in the West. We need to really change that. Otherwise, we're going to be chasing our tails, frankly, forever.
This is On Point. We're discussing wildfires, how they spread, and how they can be stopped. And we have several callers that would like to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Lois, who's calling from Springfield, Mass. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Lois.
Yeah, Hi, Lois.
I think we have too many people who are building houses and living close to places that are hazardous for wildfires, floodplains, hurricanes, and we should be actually even moving out of those places.
Interesting, the same argument made about people who build very close to the shore. Of course, everyone loves to be near the water, but then we see homes being destroyed and rebuilt. So that's a very good point. Scott and Ron, could one of you weigh in and say, do you think that's part of the answer, and is it actually likely to happen? Are we going to stop people from building in beautiful woodland areas?
Well, Scott, I guess I would say that I think this is a big piece of the issue, and Ron alluded to this earlier, the ideas of escalating costs around urban interface fire. Just yesterday, I was actually coming home from the Sierra Nevada near a town called Shingle Springs, halfway between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe. There was a small fire that looked like it got ignited on Highway 50, and it's right in the center of probably 1,000 homes within 4 miles. There were three air tankers on top of that thing, hand crews. It was only a half-acre fire. The hand crews actually picked it up, but here you have, you know, air resources on top of the fire just in case something happens. So this idea of an urban interface and building really does predispose the whole nation to excessive costs and also puts people's lives at risk. And it's something that local governments and state government really need to step up on and try to actually mitigate, because the federal government, as you know, doesn't do anything in terms of, you know, regulating where people build houses and private property.
On the other hand, the federal government does largely pick up the tab for fighting fires. So I think it's you that's made the proposal that cities and states should have to take over some of that costs. That may make them think differently about zoning and where they let people build. Do you think that's part of the solution?
I really do, and it's actually a comment that I've had, you know, a lot of state government people and others say I'm crazy because, you know, it's so expensive, you know. But I think if you don't close that loop, if you don't close a loop of how you spend money on fires in urban interface versus how you plan to build in urban interface, I don't see how we're going to get out of this conundrum. So I do think state and local governments do need to take a bigger role in actually funding fire suppression in the urban interface.
Let's go to another caller. This is Steve calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. And Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. I just had a comment and I guess a question. So if you look at the journals in Jamestown and people coming over from the East Coast and how they observed the land that's been taken care of by the Native Americans, what you see is that they equated the land to look like an English park where all the brush was burned away or cut away in order to have hunting grounds, and they did that through controlled burns. And I think it's a viable solution to engineer the wildlands to have a safe space for fire. But is there, I guess, an outlet to engineer the West as they had, you know, back in olden days in the East? Is there a way to engineer the forest to be more fireproof?
Good question, Steve. Ron and Scott, I'll let you decide which one is better to answer that. And I'll throw in another question on top of Steve's, which is that if we used to do this back when the settlers were around, what prevented it? Is it just money that's prevented it from happening as much today, or why do we see less of it now?
A couple reasons. Again, we've seen rapid growth in the urban interface, rapid growth of rural, out in some of the rural communities, people wanting to have, you know, their little 5-acre ranchette in areas that 50 years ago there was nothing. So we come back to our overarching priorities, which is firefighter and public safety. If the public's in danger, we need to go fight the fire. And it also complicates the issue of trying to do a large-scale prescribed fire or letting fires run their natural course. Now, we do in numerous areas across the West have what we call managed fires, which is you have a natural ignition. We don't aggressively suppress the fire. We'll let it run its course.
Ron Dunton, hold that thought if you would. We have to go to another break. Stay with us, and Scott Stevens, please stay with us too. This is On Point, and we're discussing wildfires, how they spread, how they can be stopped. You can join the conversation. Are we going about fire management the right way? Do you think that planned burns as a way to prevent wildfires from growing are a good idea? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about wildfire management. We're speaking with Ron Dunton. He's the Assistant Director for Fire and Aviation for the Bureau of Land Management at the National Interagency Fire Center, and with Scott Stevens, Professor of Fire Science at UC Berkeley. And Ron and Scott, I want to go to another piece of sound. This is from Chelaine, Washington, where more than 50 homes have been lost to wildfires. This woman described what it was like watching the fires from her house.
It was heartbreaking. I'm standing in my backyard. I'm looking at this whole hillside and people that we know, that we love. I'm getting phone calls from people saying, can you see if my house is on fire?
And we have a number of listeners waiting to weigh in, so I want to go to one right away. And this is Beth calling from Niskayuna, New York. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm a firefighter trainee. I've been a trainee. I'm a little bit over a year in the service. And I was going to bring a couple of points up. One, there's studies that show that for the firefighters that even survive, that long-term exposure to the heat is causing damage to their heart valves, their veins, just from being exposed to it. And the suits have gotten so heavy, they themselves are dangerous. But I wanted to also mention that, again, it's been mentioned before, we keep building in these areas, and along with the building intruding on the forest, a lot of the forest is being damaged by invasive species and whatever, and are just shooting up, going up in flames, and we have to either rewild. I think he mentioned conifer forest pine trees, but if we don't, I think that it's even dangerous now to do controlled burns with all the damage in the woods that's been caused by mankind, that doing a controlled burn is even risky. But I'll defer to him. But I do know that they give us plenty of warning about how dangerous it is to be a firefighter. And those suits.
Beth, you made
firefighting suits,
the very heavy ones. Beth, you made two great points, one about controlled burns, one about firefighters. Let's go to the controlled burns first, and we'll come to firefighters next. Scott or Ron, again, I'll let you decide who's better to answer. What is the risk when controlled burns are done that they will get out of control? I think that's a great fear of many people when they hear about prescribed burns.
Well, there's certainly a risk whenever you're lighting a fire, but that's why we very carefully plan them. We lay out a prescription under the conditions that we will light the fire, but we do have problems occasionally. In 2000, the Cerro Grande burn outside of Los Alamos got away from them and caused extensive damage to the city of Los Alamos. But we do carefully review prescriptions. We have several layers of review, but oftentimes just going out and doing a prescribed fire is not possible until we do a lot of hand treatments ahead of that, thinning ahead of that. If ponderosa pine forest has grown up to the point where it's in danger of a stand replacement fire, we can't introduce a prescribed fire. We have to go in and thin it first. And again, hugely expensive proposition. The other issue on some fuel types, we talk about low-intensity burns in ponderosa pine. There are some fuel types where we need to do high-intensity burns, where we need to do stand replacement, particularly in our pinyon juniper woodlands. So you have to light your prescribed fire during very high fire danger, and that creates its own problems in terms of explaining to the public and that risk of a rapidly growing fire. So there's a lot of challenges around prescribed fire. We have a pretty aggressive program, but it's not a simple solution.
Scott Stevens, our caller Beth, also made reference to firefighters and the risk to them, not just of possibly losing their lives, but of heart valve damage. She said research has shown that that's possible. So I want to talk a bit about firefighters. We also got a comment from a listener on Facebook. This is Robert Henneke, and he was referencing the work that firefighters do. He said, if you don't get burned or inhale too much smoke, there's angry bears, cougars, and rattlesnakes waiting to take you out. Dangerous job. Now, that may not be all that much of an exaggeration, but it also got me thinking that in a way, there's a mystique, a sort of a dashing aura surrounding a lot of firefighters, the kind of hot shots, the fire jumpers. So many people like to put on the resume that they were once a volunteer firefighter. Is it possible that we need to de-romanticize that, do you think, to sort of hammer home for people how incredibly serious this is?
Well, it is a serious endeavor, you know, both men and women on the fire lines. It's one of the most brutal jobs you've ever done. I did a little myself, but you're talking about, you know, physical exertion, hot conditions, and there is a camaraderie, though. There is a camaraderie of people, and people come back year after year to keep doing it, and it is dangerous, just dangerous like crazy. But in some ways, it seems to get in people's blood a little bit. It just gets so intense, such an intense, you know, operation. And they are making a difference. You know, fire suppression gets knocked a lot because it's causing so many problems. And there's no, in terms of long-term problems. And there's no doubt that, you know, suppression alone in some ecosystems is never going to take us where we need to go in the next 40, 50 years. But still, there's a lot of houses to try to defend, like the people on your show today losing homes. There's lives at risk. So suppression is actually incredibly important. You'll never go away. So you have to tip your hats to people that do that. A couple of people were killed this year in California alone. One actually very recently, a tree fell on a person from Shingle Springs, California. So suppression is dangerous, but it is something that many people really get into and actually stay into.
We've talked a lot this hour about how expensive it is both to fight fires and to do fire preventive work like clearing and trimming and thinning. So what is the financial solution? I mean, how are we going to pay for this if it looks like the Forest Service budget will be increasingly eaten up by fighting fires? I know some people have said treat it more like a natural disaster, which might change the calculus for paying. What are our options for finding a better way to pay for this or other sources of paying for fighting fires?
Well, this is a giant conundrum because, you know, the costs have gone up. You alluded to how the Forest Service budget is going up in terms of its proportion of total cost of firefighting. The Secretary of Agriculture over the weekend actually announced that the fire suppression budget is insufficient, so now they're going to have to start to do fire borrowing because they're spending roughly $100 million a week just putting out fires, trying to suppress fires. So,
fire borrowing meaning borrow from other budgets, meaning other things get short shrift?
That's exactly right. So the Forest Service is going to have to take dollars out of research, dollars out of recreation, dollars out of restoration, and have to start to pay their suppression budget. This has been going on now for years and years and years. So it does show the disconnect between long-term versus short-term. The short-term is really suppression, try to keep people as safe as you can, try to get fires out. Long-term is to really deal with the fuel complexes. And as Ron alluded to, some of those are frequent fire systems. Some are actually infrequent. So it's going to be tailored to the place you are. But unless we turn the corner and invest more in preventive restoration efforts, it'll get worse. I think in 10 years it could be double in terms of how much we're going to have to spend. We've got to change the trajectory.
We have a caller from Omaha. This is Lynn. And Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I used to work on a brushing crew in Northern California. I assume you know what that is.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, we would go in, and after the loggers would come through and knock down the trees, when the trees fell, they would knock branches off the trees, and they'd wind up on the ground, and it was our job to go in and pile those up to be loaded out of the forest, which would eliminate a lot of dead fuel. And I wondered if that, if this was 40 years ago, and I wondered if the logging companies are still using brushing crews, or, you know, maybe to cut expenses, they've just allowed that brush to stay there, and that's part of the fuel that you were talking about.
And Lynn, was the purpose of going back and picking up those branches to eliminate fuel, in essence, to reduce the possibility that those branches would catch fire, or did they want to use the wood for some other reason?
Well, the branches were small enough. I suppose they wound up using it for something, but I thought the purpose was just to get them out of there as fuel.
Huh. Ron Dunton, have you heard of that practice? And is it true that it doesn't happen as much? And if we brought it back, would it make much of a difference on a large scale?
No, I'd say on federal timber sales, there's requirements basically to clean up after the logging occurs. And that's cleaned up usually through piling and burning the what we refer to as the slash. And that's to clean it up so that they can replant, so the trees will regenerate. The other point I'd like to make is, you know, there's two main fire agencies within the United States government, that the United States Forest Service through the Department of Agriculture and then the Department of Interior. For the first time, one of the things the Department of Interior has done is laid out a long-term rangeland fire strategy directed by the Secretary of Interior this past winter, that to try to base a strategy around sound science, modern techniques to both fight the fire, but just as much emphasis on the prevention side of the house. So we're moving aggressively towards that, long-term looking at trying to reduce costs. the fire suppression is by far the most expensive aspect of the total program, and the only way to reduce that in the long term is we've got to get ahead of the fuels, whether or not it's on the rangeland or in the forest.
We have another caller from Rochester, Illinois. This is James, and James, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. Just a comment for your panel. My son has been a hot shot for the past 4 years for the federal government. This year, he is on a jump crew, just got back to the bottom 48 from Alaska. And I'd just like to make a comment about the wages that they make. The hotshot crews and the jump crews, if it was not for the overtime, they would be drawing public aid. Furthermore, they're not full-time employees, so they don't get full-time benefits. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, that's interesting, James. I mean, we've been talking a lot about cost, but we've been focused mainly on the cost of thinning and prevention and fighting fires. We haven't talked particularly about the personnel cost of this. Scott and Ron, is that the case, that these are actually very low-paid jobs? And is there anything that can be done about that? I mean, it certainly emphasizes that it may be dangerous as well as not particularly lucrative.
You know, the federal firefighters, the one he alluded to, a hotshot crew member and then going into the smoke jumper program, those are, lower-level scheduled appointments in terms of hourly pay. And he's exactly right, and I used to be one. You make your money on overtime. You make your money on working long shifts, and that's what a lot of these folks do. And a lot of them put themselves through college doing it. We are working to lengthen out appointments for a lot of our folks, and part of that is to maintain the overall professionalism, but also because of the longer fire seasons that we have. We are also working and implementing long-term health insurance for these employees. Previously, seasonal employees did not get health insurance. Today, they do have that option. So we're very cognizant of the sacrifices these folks make and how hard they work. So we're doing everything we can to increase their benefits, but also increase their training opportunities, increase their ability to advance in the organization. So that a few years from now, some of those folks are going to move into more senior positions where obviously their salary will go up, but they'll have the benefit of long experience and bringing that to the management side of the house.
Scott Stevens, you do fire research at UC Berkeley. On the technology side of this, is there anything on the horizon that could help us with this problem? I've read, for example, there are drones that can help, if not fight fires, then maybe detect fires, that there are fire detection cameras that can substitute for people. Anything coming that you think you feel hopeful about?
Well, I do think there's better detection systems. There's even discussion of a space-based system that actually could maybe find fires very, very quickly. And all this is going to help. It's going to show, the lightning fires, where they are, how many are there, how many human-caused fires near communities. And all that can help. The only thing that worries me a little bit is if we continue just to think about technology and technology kind of saving the day, it doesn't get at the underlying issue. The underlying issue is ecosystems and restoration. So if you had better detection, maybe some of those fires could be managed for resource benefit, allowed to burn over weeks and months in some cases to allow fire back on land to do restoration, which is direly needed. So the technology is always going to get better. But the problem is, can we use the technology for long-term advantage versus short-term? If we continue to emphasize short-term, it really doesn't change the trajectory we're on. We're really going to have issues forever.
Ron Dunton, do you think we are at a point or approaching a point where wildfires just aren't controllable anymore? Could we be headed there?
I don't believe that, no. We certainly have fires that really challenge us. We have fires that we can't stop in the near term, but eventually we are able to get to them. The Soda Fire outside of Boise was a classic example. There was a 36-hour period where we were chasing it, or it was chasing us. But eventually the crews and the aircraft were able to get a handle on it. So we're going to have uncontrollable fires, but that doesn't mean we can't get to them eventually.
Are there some things people can do in terms of fireproofing their homes? What's the latest on that front of what people can do if they live in a fire risk area? What are their best precautions, basically?
Best thing they can do is go on the internet, look at FireWise. all kinds of tips on what to do around your house in terms of what type of vegetation not to have next to your house and what type of vegetation you can have. There's a lot of things that private property owners can do to really aid firefighters. We had a case in just outside of Boise again last week where we were having to put an air tanker and put fire chemicals right alongside the houses because of the fire had the capability of getting into a subdivision. So people need to take personal responsibility, clear out from around their house. Don't have trees, big trees, right next to the house. But looking up FireWise and following the guidelines through that program can greatly benefit private property owners and benefit the firefighters because it gives them something to stand from.
Ron Dunton, thank you very much for having joined us this hour. Ron is an assistant director for fire and aviation for the Bureau of Land Management at the National Interagency Fire Center. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Scott Stevens is a professor of fire science at UC Berkeley. He's also director of the UC Center for Fire Research and Outreach. And Scott was awarded a Fulbright scholarship last year to analyze a fire management program in Australia. Scott, thank you very much to you too for being with us this hour.
I was happy to be here.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.